Clips Nation, welcome to another episode of The Lob, The Jam, The Podcast, and a very special edition of The Lob, The Jam, The Pod this week, because we have a very special guest joining us on the show this week, author of The Curse, The Colorful and Chaotic History of the LA Clippers. So pleased that he could join us this week, Mick Minnis. Mick, how are you doing today?
Really good. Thanks for having me on, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. And like I said, I've just got done reading the book, actually. It was kind of a project of mine since the new year started. Saw the book on a LA Clippers fan page on Facebook, figured I'd check it out, and just finished it. I was in Chicago over the weekend, this past weekend, for Chicago Cubs convention, for work, for business. So had plenty of time to kind of get through the last 250 pages or so, and it was fantastic read, well job all around. And kind of the plan for our interview here, for all you folks listening, is we're kind of gonna go through sort of Mick Minnis's inspiration for the book. Essentially, if for those of you that don't know, Mick is actually coming to us from Australia right now, so kind of get his background a little bit before delving into sort of the major story points and major plot lines of his entire book that chronicles the entire history of the Los Angeles Clippers. Just a fascinating read all throughout, so looking forward to it from here. But Mick, like I said, to start off, just want to get to know you a little bit more and your inspiration for the book. You know, at what point in Clippers history, I should say, did you just decide to write the book, and what was your inspiration behind it?
Yeah, so I also coach basketball down here in Australia, and so in 2008 I took a team over to the States, and we traveled around and played some games against some junior colleges and some Division III colleges. And as part of that trip, we were in California for a lot of it, and we got to go and see the Clippers opening night game in Baron Davis's first season. And so, you know, given that we had this team of young guys from Australia that were, you know, all big NBA fans, everyone was really enthusiastic to go to this game, especially given that it was Baron's first game, and you know, his homecoming to Los Angeles. And at the time, Baron was, you know, regarded as one of the elite players in the league. And so we all went to Staples with high expectations to see this, you know, big clash with the, you know, the Lakers, who were just coming off their NBA Finals loss to the Celtics the year before. The game turned out to be a blowout, and the Clippers lost by, you know, 38 points, and you know, it wasn't even close, you know, the whole way through. It was, but you know, end of the first quarter, it was already a double-digit margin. And so that was sort of the jumping-off point for me. I mean, I was really surprised. You know, in the NBA, part of the NBA is, you know, you play long seasons, and having blowout losses is not uncommon. But on opening night, when there's a new player, a new marquee signing playing their first game, to lose by, you know, almost 40 points was quite sort of astounding to me. And so when we got back to Australia, that was the sort of thing that really got me interested in the history of the franchise. And that was the launching point for the book.
Yeah, and I even remember, you know, I was, I think I was a teenager at the time when Baron Davis signed with the Clippers. And obviously you went into that story behind his signing and kind of the thinking of the front office behind that, is that it was supposed to be essentially a point guard power forward tandem, Baron Davis and Elton Brand at the time, who came off a fantastic season with the Clippers and then eventually bolts to sign with the Philadelphia 76ers at the time. And it was kind of, you know, Baron Davis ended up kind of the odd man out in that situation. They were supposed to create this powerful duo in the league that was supposed to hopefully turn the Clippers into championship contenders. And that just really never materialized. Sort of goes along with the theme of the whole curse of the Clippers. And that's kind of set up for my next question. Where do you think sort of this curse really began? And at what point did this franchise kind of seem destined for failure, no matter what splash signing or top overall pick that they had? When did it really seem like, man, this curse could be something that's real?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, you touched on that, the signing of Baron is one example of just many throughout the history of the franchise where, you know, if you look back and pause at a point in time, it looks like that the franchises made some moves and done some interesting things to put themselves in a position to be successful, and then it always seems to unravel. And the reasons why it unravels is very varied. You know, different things happen. So, I mean, look, to answer your question, I guess the easy answer would be, you know, that linking it to Donald Sterling's ownership of the team, because a lot of the sort of problems that happened during his 33 years of owning the team, you could sort of tie back to him and decisions and his philosophy of owning the team. But, I mean, I actually don't think that's the case, because, I mean, if you look at the Steve Ballmer era now, I mean, there's still been, you know, plenty of bad luck and unfortunate events that have happened since Steve bought the team. And if you look prior to Donald buying the team, I mean, right back to the second season in San Diego was when they signed Bill Walton. And, I mean, that was, you know, at the time that was viewed as, you know, a huge signing. You know, Bill Walton was one of the sort of marquee names of the league and very, very highly regarded player. He did have an extensive injury history at the time, but, you know, they signed him with the hope that everything was all right and that things were going to go well. And you know, Bill ended up playing 24 games in his first season and never being, you know, across his 6 years of the Clippers, never being healthy enough to contribute on a regular basis. So it's been a constant theme. I mean, it's been a constant theme from year two of their time in San Diego.
Yeah, I mean, and you touched upon it, Bill Walton. I'm not even sure how many, you know, big basketball fans even knew that Bill Walton was a Clipper for so long. And this was back when the team was in San Diego, like you mentioned, and you mentioned Donald Sterling. I kind of want to talk about him for a bit because, as you mentioned, he was the owner of the team for 30-plus years before the most recent sale that, you know, today's NBA fans all remember, Steve Ballmer now taking over and has injected sort of life and energy into the franchise like never before. But Donald Sterling was sort of this dark cloud that hung over the franchise for so long. But I mean, I don't know if all Clippers fans and even myself, I didn't even realize some of these stories that you touched upon in your book of just the shrewd financial moves that he dealt with. I mean, I remember a constant theme in your book was, you know, the Clippers being essentially one, unable to sign pretty much any high draft pick that they had in time for training camp because of contract disputes. And then just the problem with once those rookie contracts ended, so many players, it seemed every single player that they drafted would announce that they wanted out right after their rookie contract, and very few, if any, really re-signed. So what was kind of your overall take on Donald Sterling, his motivation for buying the team and sort of his longstanding effect on this franchise?
Yeah, I think Donald's a very interesting character. And one of the things I think that Donald Sterling, his sort of philosophy of being an NBA owner is very different, or was very different than most of his peers. You know, I think most people who buy NBA teams are successful in other areas in their life, and they almost view that the NBA team as a hobby almost, whereby, you know, that they're happy to maybe lose a little bit of money in the short term, and their ultimate goal of buying the team is to have success with the team, so to buy the team and then to help the team win a championship and to be part of an NBA championship organization. My personal opinion from all the sort of work and research and people who I spoke to about Donald was that he viewed it very differently, and that his primary, main objective of owning the Clippers was that was another part of his business portfolio, and he expected it to be profitable in the same manner as, you know, him buying an apartment complex in Los Angeles. So I think that difference put him in a completely different category to the rest of the NBA owners. And I think that he didn't care about following NBA conventions. He didn't care about what was sort of the NBA norm. He viewed the Clippers as something that were the television money from the NBA deals they negotiate with the different broadcasting networks, that money gets split you know, equally with all of the teams. So from the Clippers' perspective, that it didn't matter whether they were on national TV once in a season or 10 times in a season, they still got a 1/30th cut of whatever the TV money was. So, I mean, I think from Donald's perspective, he saw it as maybe not as important to put out a team that of highly paid players that were going to be successful and win games, because he saw it as, well, if I put out any sort of team, I'm still going to get my proportion of this money. People are still going to buy tickets. It's LA. People are going to buy tickets to come and see, even to come and see the opposition teams play. So I think that Donald's whole philosophy of ownership was very different than that of all the other NBA owners.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, growing up as a kid and being a Clippers fan, you know, kind of started in the late 90s and early 2000s, and throughout Donald Sterling's ownership, you know, kind of heard certainly negative things being discussed when folks around the NBA and the media talked about Donald Sterling and kind of the racism and bigotry that kind of went on behind the scenes. And that didn't really come out until that falling out, you know, just a few years ago when the Clippers were in that first round playoff series against the Golden State Warriors and the effect that that had on the franchise at the time. And that's really when all of that behind the scenes things with Donald Sterling came to light. And it was just incredible to not only, you know, experience that in a playoff series and have a team deal with that, but also in your book, you chronicle this a lot, but also I remember growing up, you know, even in the mid 2000s, as you know, normally teams, when they're trying to sell tickets, sell season tickets, get people out to the arena, they're selling their own team, you know, and hoping for a playoff spot. Whereas the Clippers, I remember pretty much up until recently, they would advertise whoever was coming into the arena on the visiting side. It was, you know, if Kobe and the Lakers are playing at Staples Center, come watch Kobe for much cheaper ticket prices than you normally would if it was a Lakers home game. Or, you know, if LeBron James was coming to the arena, come get your tickets so you can see LeBron James. It would be no mention of the Clippers themselves playing. It was always focused on the opposition and sort of, you know, you get the cheapest ticket in the league because it's the Clippers, but you're also watching the NBA's best on the other side blow out the Clippers by 20-plus points if the other team was good. And so I want to move our conversation now to something we just mentioned earlier, Bill Walton. Bill Walton was kind of the first superstar, if you will, in the Clippers franchise after they moved from Buffalo to San Diego, played, as you mentioned, with the Clippers for 6 years. The first time that they really went all in, a massive trade to bring Bill Walton in, and he was kind of viewed as the savior for this franchise at the time for the foreseeable future, and it never materialized because of injury. You know, his legs just were never underneath him, and it was really just kind of a tragic story gone wrong that his career went off the rails so quickly because of those injuries. Was he really the first major idea gone wrong for this franchise?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I mean, it's easy to say in hindsight that it was a bad idea to sign him because, I mean, like, he was signed as a free agent, but back then the NBA rules had if you signed somebody as a free agent, you had to compensate the other team. So the first season in San Diego, the Clippers surprised a lot of people by doing really well. They won 43 games, and they just missed out on making the playoffs, and they had a really nice team. So then they signed Bill Walton, but rather than him being added to the nice core that they had, they then had to compensate Portland. So even though he was a free agent, and even though he wanted out of Portland, they had to compensate Portland. And at the time, it was up to the two teams to negotiate this compensation package. And I deal with this in the book. The Portland were asking for this, you know, ridiculous package of, you know, 5 first-round draft picks and 2 members of the Clippers starting lineup, and the Clippers were saying there's no way we're going to do that. So at the end, it was left to the NBA to decide what the compensation package was going to be, and what they decided sort of decimated the Clippers lineup. You know, they lost 2 members of their starting 5. They lost, you know, multiple first-round draft picks. They also had to pay money. And so at the end of it, the team was a lot weaker, but they had Bill Walton. And so Bill Walton, at his best, was an MVP. He was, you know, arguably the best player in the league at the time. So once that happened, they really reliant on Bill being able to play 70-plus games and Bill being at his best, and that just wasn't the case. He wasn't able to play. You know, he just throughout his time with the Clippers, it was one thing after another. There was one time in the early 80s where he'd come back from his foot injury, which is, the major problem he had was, stress fractures in his feet. But he'd come back from his foot injury and he grabbed a defensive rebound and hit his hand against the backboard and broke his finger in his first game back. So it was just one thing after another with Bill. And so, the team was relying on him being at his best. And it wasn't a matter of whether he was at his best or not. It was just a simple fact of him not being healthy enough to contribute on a regular basis.
Yeah, and it really, as I mentioned, throughout the book that you've written, it's injuries have a lot to do with this curse, so to speak. And for all the recent Clippers fans, we've experienced it for the last couple of years and just this season. I mean, Chris Paul, we got the news. Chris Paul now out with an injury with his torn tendon in his left thumb. And Blake Griffin already on the shelf. Chris Paul had a hamstring issue earlier in the season. Last year in the playoffs, both Blake Griffin and Chris Paul get injured and are out for the playoffs in the same game in that first round series against Portland. So, I mean, it all harkens back to that Bill Walton situation in that the Clippers, and that's why I encourage all of you Clippers fans to read this book. This is not just a one-time thing for this franchise. It seems that every single superstar, high-level player that comes to this team has some sort of devastating injury that derails the entire season. And Bill Walton was certainly sort of the first player to experience that sort of thing. And it just set the tone for the rest of this franchise's history. The 1980s, just really a dark decade for this team. Never won more than 36 games, didn't qualify for the playoffs. Before finally lucking out in the 1988 draft and having the number one overall pick, using it on Danny Manning. And Manning, I want you, Mick, to kind of comment on his stint with the Clippers and his effect on them in making the playoffs. And was he really kind of their first real hope for sustained success?
I think perhaps Bill Walton was. And then after Bill Walton, he was probably the next great hope. Danny Manning was the equivalent of, he's one of those draft picks where everybody knew who was going to go number one. He was, consensus number one pick and the best player in the college game at the time. So he was the equivalent of, he was the 80s equivalent of Tim Duncan or the 2000, LeBron in 2004. Like, he was the guy that everybody knew was going to go number one. And it was, if you got the number one pick in the 88 draft, then you were really lucky because you got this guy that you could build your franchise around. And then, they drafted him and they straight away started using his image, his face in promotional campaigns around Los Angeles, billboards and everything. But as you spoke about before, Patrick, they couldn't sign him to a contract. There was this really sort of acrimonious contract negotiation. And Danny ended up missing all of training camp, all of the exhibition schedule and the first four or five regular season games. It was so bad that David Stern had to personally interject into the contract negotiations because the league was sort of the view that, hey, here's our number one draft pick that, the NBA should be celebrating and should be out there playing, and he's not playing because the Clippers and his agent can't agree. And then when he finally does start playing, he starts off a little bit slow. He's not in the starting lineup straight away, and then he starts to find his feet and he moves into the starting lineup and he's scoring 20 points a game and, starts getting close to triple-double numbers. Very versatile. Danny Manning was kind of ahead of his time. He was, this really versatile player that could handle the ball and pass like a guard, but possessed the sort of size and strength of a post player. And then get to the start of 89 and he does his knee. And he's out. Not only is he out for the rest of that season, but I think most basketball fans, the consensus view is that Danny Manning was never the same player post his knee injury than what he was before it. Now, that's not to say he still had a very good career for the Clippers. He led them to two playoff appearances. He was a two-time All-Star. He did a lot to sort of to move the franchise from being sort of the in the 80s the Clippers were almost not viewed as a proper NBA team. You know, they were it was kind of like a CBA team playing in the NBA. Though, you know, sometimes in that late 80s, that mid to late 80s period, some of the teams they fielded were so substandard. And Manning moved them to being a legitimate team where they had, you know, two playoff appearances. But like many other Clippers, when the time came to re-sign as a free agent, he opted to go elsewhere. And with the Clippers knowing that he was about to leave, they decided to trade him.
I mean, as you mentioned, kind of the substandard rosters that the Clippers would field in the late 80s there. I mean, the 86-87 season, the team only won 12 games. And that's even kind of covered in one of the chapters of your book. You know, thank God for the 1973 Philadelphia 76ers, who have the worst record of all time, and thankfully for the Clippers then they didn't set the lowest win total that season. And the following season, the season before, they were able to get the number one pick and draft Danny Manning, they only won 17 games. So that's a 2-year period where the franchise won only 29 games. I mean, 29 games, that's terrible for one season, let alone combined for two seasons. So that kind of shows everyone where the Clippers were at the time of drafting Danny Manning, sort of the position they were in. And yet, despite all of that failure of years past, just again, the failure to sign Danny Manning in time for training camp took the commissioner getting involved in the contract negotiations so that they can get the number one overall pick on the court, as you mentioned. And he was able to eventually lead the Clippers in the playoffs. And that was the 91-92 season. First time that the Clippers franchise, if you don't count when they were the Buffalo Braves, first time the Clippers were ever in the playoffs, made it back-to-back seasons, losing in the first round both times to the Utah Jazz and Houston Rockets. Very close 5-game series, which if you NBA fans recall at the time in the first round was a best of 5. So, and then a peculiar trade to get rid of Danny Manning, you know, trading him for Dominique Wilkins, who at the time was at the pretty much final years of his career in a first round draft pick. And again, it sort of set the Clippers up for another dead period in their franchise history, and that was certainly a lot of them. It wasn't until 1998 where again the team gets the number one overall pick, and this was sort of an interesting draft. The Clippers take Michael Olowokandi, who had only really started playing basketball at the age of 15, and this was one of my sort of favorite stories in the book that you wrote about, was kind of Michael Olowokandi's journey to the NBA, certainly unlike any other. Talk about Michael Olowokandi for a bit. And was there really a consensus that Olowokandi was the right choice for the Clippers?
Yeah, it was one of my favorite chapters to write. I really enjoyed, because, you know, Michael Olowokandi is sort of universally regarded as he was a bust. He was a really bad number one draft pick. And that's kind of, for a lot of people, that's kind of where the conversation about Michael Olowokandi starts and ends. And in actuality, his journey to the NBA is really fascinating. He was a 19-year-old Nigerian kid living in London because his dad was a diplomat. And he decided on his birthday that he was going to try and play in the NBA. Now, mind you, he had never played basketball at all. Never. Like, the most he had done was he'd gone with a couple of friends, and the college where he was attending in London had like one hoop, not even a court, just a single hoop. And he'd gone there and had a few shots with some friends. And from that, he went to the library and he picked up a book, you know, a guide to American colleges, and he started calling people, just cold calling. He called Duke, he called Georgetown, and just said, I'm a 7-foot guy and I want to come play for your school. And the big school that he rang just didn't take him seriously. He wasn't able to get on the phone with any of the coaches or anyone who important. So then after a while, he said, okay, I've got to change my approach here. And so he opened the guidebook up at a random page and plonked his finger down, and he landed on the University of the Pacific, which is, you know, a school in Northern California, and placed a call, and same thing, you know, he made his pitch and said, this is who I am, and I'd like to come play for your school. And the assistant coach who answered the phone, you know, they used to get a lot of, being a smaller Division One school, they used to get a lot of phone calls from people who thought they could go and play there, just sort of delusional youngsters who thought their game, their ability was a lot better than what it was. And the only thing that kept the conversation going for more than 10 seconds was the fact that he said he was 7 foot tall. And from there, you know, he flew over to America, you know, enrolled at the school, and in the first season he sat on the bench and you know, didn't know anything about basketball. I mean, I spoke to a number of coaches from Pacific, and it was amazing to hear, like, when he got there, he didn't know how to pivot, he didn't know how to make a layup, he didn't understand the rules of the game, he didn't know about fouling out, he didn't know. One story I was told was in a game, he made a basket and got fouled, so he went to the free throw line, he shot the first free throw and it missed, and the other team rebounded, and they proceeded to sort of advance the ball up the court, and Michael was just standing at the free throw line looking baffled, like, when am I going to get my other free throw? Because he thought you get two shots when you get fouled. This was his first season, and he only played 3 years at Pacific because the time he spent studying in London was counted as his freshman year. So this was his sophomore season. So from that, by the end of his senior year, he went to being the number one overall draft pick. And I mean, that's an amazing journey. And just to sort of prove how amazing it is, at the end, when he got drafted number one, him and his agent actually went to Hollywood, and they met with executives from DreamWorks film studio with the idea of exploring the option of making a movie about Michael Olowokandi's life story. And I mean, that shows you how amazing his journey was to get to the NBA. Now, you asked Patrick about, you know, was he a consensus number one draft pick? Definitely not. And that was kind of, you know, the opposite of, like we spoke before about the 88 draft and Danny Manning, where he was a consensus number one pick. Michael's draft was more one of those years where there was a lot of good players, but no one was quite sure about who should go number one. But having the kind of revisionist history is, it was a big mistake to draft Olowokandi, and nobody thought it was a good idea to draft Olowokandi. That's not true. If you look back at the time, and the people I spoke to from that time as well, the consensus seems to be like, yeah, he's probably the right choice to make. You know, it wasn't like when the Clippers drafted him, people were laughing at them saying, well, who's this guy? You know, this guy wasn't even projected in the top 10. He was projected as being one of the top few picks. It was really came down to Michael Olowokandi or Michael Bibby. And Vancouver, who drafted second, their general manager said at the time that he would have taken Olowokandi if they had had the first pick. So in hindsight says the Clippers probably got it wrong, but at the time he was viewed as someone who had this amazing trajectory to get themselves into the NBA, and the sort of view was that if that growth continued to happen, that he could become a really dominant post player once he got in the league.
Yeah, and it's easy to look back at that draft, because I remember reading in the book kind of exactly what you mentioned, is that unlike the Danny Manning draft, there really was no consensus number one pick, as you mentioned. I mean, it really came down to Olowokandi and Mike Bibby, and just to refresh everyone's memory on that draft, it's easy to look back at the draft and see, oh, Anton Jameson taken number four, Vince Carter taken number five, Dirk Nowitzki went later at pick number nine, Paul Pierce, current Clipper, he was taken number 10 in that draft. So it's easy to look back. Hindsight's always 20/20 to essentially think back, oh, wow, the Clippers could have had Mike Bibby instead of Olowokandi, could have had Anton Jameson, Vince Carter. But at the same time, I mean, that's the risk associated with taking anyone in a draft, is that at the time you don't know, you can put in the work. And there was certainly the potential was there for Olowokandi as, you know, a 7 foot center who played great in college at the University of the Pacific. Like you said, great potential, and it just never really materialized. The work ethic wasn't necessarily there under the coaching staff at the time, and injuries also played a part, as with any high prospect, high potential player that the Clippers ever received. And eventually he signed with the Minnesota Timberwolves when he became a free agent, and was never really too big of a factor there either. So, you know, it's easy to label Olowokandi as the biggest bust in NBA history if you compare it to where he was picked number one overall. And I mean, yeah, granted, he should be held to a higher standard, but at the same time, there wasn't really any alternative for the Clippers that, you know, that really fit in. And like you mentioned, at the time, it really wasn't something that the Clippers were laughed at for choosing. So again, going along with the curse, it was just another bad luck, ho-hum kind of thing that happened to this franchise. And then, you know, I remember this next story vividly, and this was probably, if the Olo Candy story was my favorite, this might have been my second favorite, just that whole Kobe Bryant saga. And just, I don't think people realize just how close Kobe was to signing with the Clippers after opting out of the final year of his contract in 2004 with the Lakers. Talk about that for briefly, and just how close Kobe was to signing with the team and potentially altering this franchise's entire history.
Yeah, I mean, for the people I spoke with, and the research that I did, the viewpoint that I formed was that he was very close. And I think Laker fans like to look back at it and say he would. There's no way Kobe would have ever gone to the Clippers.
Right, right.
And I mean, and it's easy to look. It's easy to look at these things in hindsight and say, well, that would never have happened. I mean, but I mean, like when LeBron James left Cleveland and went to Miami, if you had to say, oh, this is going to be this storyline where LeBron's going to return to Cleveland and he's going to play there, and he's going to win a championship. I mean, you would say that there's no way that would have happened. But then it did happen, and it's like now that it's happened, it's kind of we can wrap our heads around that as a concept. So the idea of Kobe leaving the Lakers in the peak of his career and coming and playing for the Clippers, it seems conceptually really hard to get your head around. But at the time, I mean, Kobe was living in, obviously he was living in Anaheim, he's living in Southern California. His only options for playing in the NBA without uprooting his family was to re-sign with the Lakers or to sign with the Clippers. Clippers were offering him a max deal. The Clippers had by far a better roster at the time. I mean, if you took Kobe off the Lakers and then you looked at the Lakers roster and you looked at the Clippers roster, I mean, the Clippers had a fantastic young roster at the time. And then you add Kobe Bryant into that mix and it's like, wow, you know, this is going to be a really good team. You could have paired Kobe with Elton Brand. And then, you know, you also had Sean Livingston. And then, you know, Chris Kaman and Corey McGeady. I mean, it's a really nice group of players. So from that perspective, Kobe would have been thinking, okay, well, we've got a good team here. Mike Dunleavy had taken over as coach, and he was well-respected coach around the league. And the Clippers were showing a willingness to start spending more money. Now, the only person who would be able to definitively say one way or another how close he was to signing would be Kobe himself. I mean, the people close to the negotiations, so Elgin and Mike Dunleavy and Donald Sterling and then, you know, people on the Lakers side, they would be able to give their viewpoint from speaking to him. But Kobe himself said years later that he was really close to signing with the Clippers. And if you talk about sort of a great what if in the history of the franchise, there are a few sort of real turning points. But if they had been able to sign Kobe at that point in his career, which was he was just coming into the peak of his career, I mean, it would have been sort of amazing to have seen what would have eventuated.
It was absolutely fascinating. Like I said, in addition to that Olua Candy story, the chapter on that Kobe Bryant offseason saga, and like you said, how close he was to signing with the Clippers was a fascinating read because, as you mentioned, I don't think growing up in the LA Orange County era and growing up around a bunch of Laker fans, I don't think everyone realizes just how close that was to being, you know, finalized and Kobe being a Clipper. And that sort of segued into, you know, you mentioned how good of a roster the Clippers had at the time, better than the Lakers at that point. The 2005-06 season, where I think prior to really this era of Clippers, and team really holds a special place in my heart because it was really the first time that I think the Clippers had legitimate championship aspirations, especially as the playoffs went along. And just to refresh everyone's memory, 2005-06 Clippers starting lineup of Sam Cassell, Cuttino Mobley, Corey Maggette, Elton Brand, Chris Kaman, and Sean Livingston coming off the bench, sort of learning from Sam Cassell. You know, in your opinion, could that team really have won it all? And talk about a little bit about their playoff run that year.
Interesting. I mean, one of the things that was quite interesting, if you look back at MDA history, that sort of mid-2000s period was a bit of a downtime in terms of there was no real dominant team in that time. And if you look at the championship winners, you know, I mean, Detroit won in 04. In 06, you had Miami win. And I believe Miami won 52 games that season, which would be one of the lowest win totals for an NBA champion in the league's history. The next year, the Spurs won. And you know, Cleveland made the finals with, you know, not a, historically speaking, not a very strong roster. So there was definitely a window there where that Clippers team was one of the most talented teams in the league. You know, the matchup with the Suns, you know, those, what happened in game five is seen as a real turning point in terms of what would happen with that series, where, you know, at the end, where Daniel Ewing was subbed on and, you know, they hit a three-pointer and sent it into overtime, and then the Clippers lost. And that's obviously seen as a real turning point. I mean, if they had have won that game and then returned home to play game six, yeah, potentially that they would have knocked Phoenix out and they would have progressed to the conference finals. I guess the more interesting thing is Matt, look, I think it's a bit far-fetched to suggest they could have won in 2006. I mean, more interesting would be 2007, 2008. Could they have built on what they had established there? And one of the things that prevented them is back to this thing we've been talking about for the whole podcast is injuries. You know, the next season, Sean Livingston suffers, you know, one of the most horrific on-court injuries. In the history of, not just the history of NBA or all basketball, in the history of all sports, I mean, it's really uncomfortable to watch how he does his knee, and such an unfortunate, you know, accident to have happen. So then I think moving forward from that 06 team, I think they were looking to build on that nucleus of Elton Brand and Sean Livingston as their point guard. So then Sean Livingston's career is now thrown into complete jeopardy. And then the following offseason, Elton Brand is working out with Chris Kaman and playing one-on-one. And then Elton Brand is injured, and he's out for essentially a whole season. He ended up coming back and playing the final eight games. But there you have the two sort of building blocks that you would be looking to sort of put a team around and compete for a championship, and both of them going down with you know, really serious injuries in the space of 6 or 7 months of each other. Again, it's that sort of unfortunate bad luck that seems to just constantly plague the franchise.
Yeah, and it's, again, like you harped upon, and we've talked about this entire episode, it's just injuries have always derailed any sort of optimism, any sort of, you know, a high-level player that this team has gotten, and that middle 2000s to late 2000s era of Clippers basketball was sort of a theme again of that, where that team, as you mentioned, there really wasn't a dominant team in the NBA. And after that 05-06 year, where the Clippers in 2006 were come one game short of making it to a conference final, losing in game seven, which I remember you talking about in the book, is that the Clippers, after winning that game six in the second round series against the Suns, this was that team that was coached under Mike D'Antoni with Steve Nash and Amari Stoudemire at the helm. There was one day of rest between every single game in that series before a three-day break between game six and seven, and Steve Nash noticeably tired after running that frenetic pace of an offense that entire series. And keep in mind, they had just come off a seven-game series, I believe, or a six or seven-game series in the first round against the Lakers. So a taxing series there, a taxing series against the Clippers, and then 3 days rest before game seven, and the Suns absolutely ran away with it, preventing the Clippers from reaching their first ever conference final. And that's something that even this current era of Clippers, the Blake Griffin, Chris Paul, DeAndre Jordan, Doc Rivers era, hasn't been able to accomplish as well. And even though it is the best period of success in franchise history, that curse, so to speak, still remains. You still have injuries to Blake Griffin and Chris Paul, bad endings in the playoffs. You know, I remember that series in the second round against Oklahoma City where the Clippers, specifically Chris Paul, play the absolute worst 45 minutes of basketball, or 45 seconds of basketball, I should say, at the end of game five in OKC to potentially go up 3-2 and then lose that series in six games. The meltdown against Houston, where the team was up 3-1 in the series and then up by 19 points late in the third quarter at home in game six with a chance to finish it off. So it's even though, as you mentioned, with the ownership change from Sterling to Steve Ballmer, that this sort of dark cloud sort of looms large, and it feels like it's always in the back of everyone's minds, which leads me to this question of, do you see this era that we're currently in with the Clippers, with Blake, with Chris Paul, with DeAndre Jordan, with Doc Rivers, do you see it ending up with a championship, whether it's this season or next season? And kind of also to go with that, do you see Blake and Chris Paul staying and re-signing at season's end?
Yeah, so I think maybe I have a different view than a lot of Clipper fans about this. I think that the thing that Doc's done well is being patient with the current group of players. I think that if you look throughout NBA history, there are examples of teams making big changes and then that leading to a championship. But those examples are the exception. They're not the rule. I think that throughout NBA history, the way you win championships is by getting a core of good, talented players and then just sort of tweaking around the edges of that, but keeping faith in that core and letting them stay together and letting them develop and letting them grow as a group. And if you look at the five seasons that in the Chris Paul era, so since Chris Paul joined the team, and their five playoff runs, every single one of those playoff runs have been disrupted by forces that are almost beyond the team's control. I mean, the 2 years under Vinny Del Negro where they made the playoffs, both of those playoff runs were disrupted by injury. So if you remember the very first year with Del Negro, Chris Paul and Blake Griffin and Caron Butler were all injured during that playoff series. Now, they were all injured to the point they could still play, but they were playing below their best. And you know, you're not going to make it far in the Western Conference with your three-star players all carrying, you know, semi-serious injuries. The next year under Del Negro was when Blake got the really bad ankle sprain and you know, basically couldn't play. Then the third year of the Chris Paul era was the Donald Sterling saga, which, you know, I think you'd be hard pressed to find an NBA team that would be able to maintain their focus throughout four different playoff series, because that's what you need. You need to win four seven-game series to win a championship. It's really, really. I mean, I think the team did remarkably well to knock Golden State out and to take Oklahoma City to six games with all that sort of chaos happening off the court around them. And then even, you know, the 2015 playoffs that are remembered for the meltdown against Houston. But you got to remember also, in that series, Chris Paul, I mean, in that playoff run, Chris Paul injured his hamstring and missed the first two games of that Houston series. And when he came back and played the next five games, he was still not 100% healthy. And then obviously last season you had both Chris and Blake getting injured in the same playoff game. To me, if I was the owner of the team, if I was Steve Ballmer, I would be looking at that and saying, this group hasn't had a chance yet to make a playoff run without some sort of external force disrupting them. And if you look at the group on paper, I think that, you know, the collection of Blake and Chris and DeAndre and JJ Redick is one of the best rosters in the league. So if I was Doc, if I was Steve Ballmer, I would just continue to have, even with this season, you know, it's disrupted again by injuries, I would continue. If I could re-sign both Chris and Blake, I would re-sign both Chris and Blake. I would still be open to the prospect of a trade if something came along that I thought would improve the team, but I wouldn't be looking to blow the roster up just for the sake of doing something. I think throughout NBA history, that approach hasn't worked very well. The closest comparison I can draw to this current Clippers team is the Dirk Nowitzki Dallas Mavericks teams, where, you know, that for a lot of years they were in the playoffs, they're in the playoffs, they made one NBA finals, but they were never able to win. And I think Mark Cuban had faith in Dirk as his franchise player, and Jason Terry as a sort of, you know, second in command. And he more tweaked around the edges. And eventually, Dallas's time came, and they were able to win a championship. That's the closest comparison I can see to this current Clippers group.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it's no question that the Clippers absolutely should try and sign Blake Griffin and Chris Paul long term, because if one or both of them leave, or any other scenario where you trade one of them away, I don't think that you're going to have any sort of other success without really completely blowing up the entire roster and sort of starting fresh. And that there's no guarantee in that either. You know, we always talk about as fans, and I feel like a lot of the national narrative is, you know, if it's not working for a couple years, blow it up, start anew. But there's no guarantees when you're rebuilding and being a lottery team for years on end. There's no sure thing. And I think that's kind of not necessarily that I forgot where the Clippers came from, even when I was a fan as a kid, and just how bad the team was. But I think after reading your book again and just getting my mind refreshed on all that has happened to this franchise throughout their entire history, it's just that as Clipper fans, I think we should be absolutely grateful and optimistic for what this current era of Clippers has done and the way the seasons have ended in the playoffs with, yes, very disappointing losses. But again, as you mentioned, sort of seemingly forces that they can't control coming to end their seasons, especially, you know, Josh Smith hitting 4 or 5 3-pointers at the end of that Game 6 in the Rockets series back in 2015. It's just things like that, unfortunately, seem to happen constantly to this Clippers team. And I hope that this season that isn't the case, and that both Blake Griffin and Chris Paul quickly return to health in time to get a couple games under their belt and maybe get into a sort of a groove before the playoffs roll around, and we'll see what they can do from there. Because again, I agree with you in that this roster as it's currently constructed, when healthy, is a top 3 or 4 roster in the entire NBA. And which leads me to sort of my final question for you for our interview here. Where do you see this current team finishing at the end of the season, both, you know, in the regular season and ultimately in the playoffs? I think a common theme that me and the other writers and contributors to this podcast, you know, beginning of the year, we were very, very hopeful, optimistic that it would end in a conference finals appearance. And I'm still hopeful that that can happen, though it's more reserved now with the injuries that have happened. So where do you see this team finishing at year's end?
Yeah, look, I think they're probably going to end up anywhere with a 3rd to 7th seed, which is a bit unfortunate given that, yeah, like the start of the season, I felt optimistic that they were going to be a 1 or 2 seed. But given the injuries that are occurring, I think 3rd seed is the best you could hope for, and it's probably more likely to be 4, 5, or 6. Look, I think once we get to playoffs, I think they have the potential to make a run in the playoffs. I mean, I think they can definitely beat San Antonio and Houston even without home court advantage. But I mean, it's like all the other playoffs. If you look back over the last 5 years of the franchise, it's like all the other series. It's like you're going to play another really good team, and it's going to sort of depend a little bit on, you know, what the health of your players and the, you know, whether you have, you know, there's an element of luck involved in terms of how these games go. But I think that I'm more optimistic about Chris's injury. I look at it as, well, if he's back early to mid-March, say, that still gives you 4 or 5 weeks for them to play together as a group again. And these guys have played together now for years, and there's good chemistry within the team. So I don't see it as being a huge problem. If he comes back and he's 100% and Blake's able to come back and he's 100%, well, if they finished in the 6th spot, do you think Houston would be happy about the prospect of playing the Clippers in the first round? I would imagine they would hate the idea of matching up with the Clippers in the first round. So I think that I still think they have the potential to make a deep playoff run. Whether they're able to beat Golden State, that's still something that's beyond this group, but, and maybe this season's been too disrupted for that to happen. But yeah, I'm optimistic that a lot's going to depend on the health of Chris and the health of Blake. But one of the pros, I guess, Patrick, that comes from these recent injuries is that when the playoffs come around, that both Chris and Blake will have fresher legs than some of the other NBA superstars because they won't have ground out a 82-game season. That they've had a little bit of time off. Now, they obviously wouldn't want this time off, but that could also become a positive come playoff time.
Yeah, and hopefully, as you mentioned, the fresh legs have something to do with it. Obviously, we hope that the chemistry is still the same, but nonetheless, if this team is healthy going into the playoffs, completely healthy, regardless of what seed they're at, they're definitely a force to be reckoned with, and I'm in full agreement with you there. No team in that top three would want to see in the Clippers in the first round, whether, you know, if the Clippers drop to a 6 or 7, that means facing the Spurs or the Rockets. As a Clippers fan, I'll certainly take my chances and be rooting for this team until the season ends and beyond, and be hopeful for this offseason that the roster stays. So once again, Mick Minnis, thank you very much for joining us. Just for the folks of you, reminding you, Mick Minnis, author of The Curse, Colorful and Chaotic History of the LA Clippers. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on ClipperCurse.com, on Instagram at ClipperCurse. Hit Mick Minnis up on Facebook, as I did in order to score this interview, facebook.com/Mick.Minnis.7, or at Twitter, you can find him at MMinnis8. So, Mick Minnis, thank you very much for joining us all the way from Australia. We look forward to hearing from you again, and thank you again for joining us on the podcast.
No, thanks a lot for having me, Patrick. It's been a real pleasure having a chat with you.
Absolutely. And as always, folks, go Clippers.
Bingo! Jay in the corner for three. Bingo! Two in a row.